In 1971, William Friedkin directed The French Connection. It received 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture of the Year. In 1974, he directed The Exorcist. It made history. Since then, Friedkin has spent over 2 years in 5 countries on 3 continents creating his latest film, an unusual adventure into the realm of suspense. By their past, robbed of their future, trapped in a life that was also a death. 4 men take an incredible chance, face an impossible challenge, and risk the only thing they have left to lose. Roy Scheider, in a new film by William Friedkin. Sorcerer, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
And we're back.
We seem to always start off with a very awkward "we're back" and then some laughter. That's like our thing. No, like genuine laughter, no. Not like that kind of laughter.
It's real.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, well, here we are, one more time. Again.
How you doing, CJ?
How are you doing? I had a pretty fucking horrible day earlier today, so.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that's all right. That's but now I get to talk a little shop with you, so that's gonna make it a little better.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah,
I haven't had lunch yet, so.
Oh yeah.
That might explain my low energy.
Maybe I had a little salad. I was planning to go hiking when we were done, and then have dinner. But I mean, it looks pretty ominous out there. Hmm. So.
Well, I guess depending how long this recording is. The thunderstorm warning I had was only until 4:48 in Baltimore County, so.
That's Baltimore, Maryland, for all of our international listeners.
Oh, quit laughing.
All right, well, what have you seen lately? We're here to talk about Sorcerer, but we'll get to that in a second.
Okay. To be honest, what have you seen lately? Let me pull up my list here.
Well, we saw Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
how'd you
did
like that?
See it. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's certainly.
This is the 1984 film, right?
What? No.
Because you said you enjoyed it.
Did you not? Did you not enjoy it?
So you mean the 1984 film?
Did
right?
you not enjoy it? Are you serious?
It had its moments. It was all right.
Okay.
It was all right.
I mean, overall, I enjoyed the film quite a bit. It's. I think a lot of the humor hits, and despite the fact I'm not really. I'm a Melissa McCarthy fan. Like, going back, I don't think I've ever seen a film that she starred in.
Like, ever?
Ever.
You didn't see Spy, Tammy?
No, no, no. I haven't even seen Bridesmaids.
What the hell else is she in?
She does, like, 2 movies a year.
Spy, Tammy, Bridesmaids.
I mean, she was in Central Intelligence, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you're not supposed to tell people that. That's a spoiler.
Is it?
Shows up at the end.
I thought we were talking about spoilers. We were talking about Sorcerer.
Yeah, but only about Sorcerer. They didn't tune in to hear spoilers for Sorcerer, only to get spoilers for a different movie.
You can just edit this out.
No, we're keeping it.
All right. I guess, well, since the last time we recorded, you know, I saw the BFG, Swiss Army Man, and we saw Infiltrator also last week.
Infiltrator was solid, but not great.
I thought it was just okay. I think ultimately forgettable, but
yeah.
I've also, I guess, been rewatching a lot of.
I put Infiltrator in the same category that I would put like the Iceman with Michael Shannon.
Oh. See, I like the Iceman quite a bit, but yeah, I guess.
I mean, like, it's good, but it's not great. It's got a strong central performance. It's a period piece. You know, but ultimately, it's not one of the better examples of the genre.
Yeah, I like Iceman quite a bit, but I
just like it because Chris Evans is in it.
I like it because Michael Shannon's in it.
Chris Evans plays the ice cream man.
But it's ultimately a film I don't think I'll revisit anytime soon.
Yeah. Great period detail in the Iceman, though.
I don't know, Michael Shannon.
Not to get us off on a tangent.
He's pretty chilling. So I think I would think Michael Shannon. The opening scene, I was kind of sold on the film.
Yeah, he's really good. I mean, used properly, Michael Shannon is an extremely effective guy. So, but is that all you had to say about Ghostbusters? I thought Chris Hemsworth and Kate McKinnon kind of are the funniest.
Yeah, I think overall, from what I've read, a lot of people would agree with you. Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones.
That's what happens when you're right.
Yeah.
A lot of people tend to agree with you.
They're, I don't regularly watch Saturday Night Live at all, so I wasn't really familiar with either of their work. But, you know, I thought they were pretty good. Definitely Kate McKinnon as, what's her character's name? Holtzman. I could definitely see her being kind of like the breakaway character for the film, anyway.
Yeah.
The film did it do okay in the box office this past weekend?
I did not check to see what it did box office wise over the weekend, but
I talked to a lot of people who saw it, so it probably did pretty well. It probably, well, certainly more than like Infiltrator, I bet. Soft Wednesday release.
Ghostbusters opened at number 2 with 46 million behind The Secret Life of Pets, which made 50.8 million.
Yeah. Secret Life of Pets was in the second week, right?
Yeah. Second week, it's made $200 million already. Legend of Tarzan was number 3. Finding Dory was number 4. Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates was number 5. Purge Election Year, Central Intelligence, The Infiltrator, The BFG, and Independence Day 2 rounded out the top 10.
It was
a fairly soft weekend, though. I mean, aside from Secret Life of Pets and Ghostbusters, nobody else made over $11 million. So
Independence Day didn't make...
No, Independence Day was number 10. It made $3.5 million.
Okay.
Yeah. And deservedly so. It wasn't very good.
I'd agree with you there.
Yeah. So, well, let's just jump into Sorcerer.
Okay.
Do you want to describe it? What is Sorcerer, Cesar?
Well, Sorcerer is a 1977 William Friedkin film. I don't know. It's kind of hard to... I can tell you what it's about.
I can give you the specifics. It was directed by William Friedkin.
I know what it's about, but how do I describe this film?
It's based on the novel Wages of Fear by Georges Arnaud. Screenplay was written by Waylon Greene, and it was previously adapted very famously in 1953 for the screen by Henri-Georges Clouzot. And that film is considered a classic. It's in the Criterion Collection. Sorcerer... I have seen that version, but it's been a really, really, really long time.
I've never seen it.
So I wouldn't say that I'm comfortable, you know, like drawing the distinctions between the two. I think we should just focus on Sorcerer as a...
That would work for me.
Yeah, well, because when Friedkin made the film, I read some excerpts from his book on Sorcerer, you know, as I was preparing for this. And, he had seen Wages of Fear... But he went back to the original book, and he claims he hadn't seen it in 20 years, so that when he made the movie, he was looking at the source material with fresh eyes. So there's a lot of changes. The prologue for the four characters is completely created for this film. So, but yeah, it's four guys, all...
From different walks of life.
Yeah, and different countries. Who all end up in the same shithole Mexican town working for an American oil company. And when there is a giant explosion, I guess it's domestic terrorism, right? It's locals who are trying to sabotage the American oil company.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a giant inferno. The only way to put the inferno out is to bring in explosives. And this is an interesting tidbit that I did not know, because I watching the film, I think the first time, I was kind of amazed that they fly 218 miles to this little shack where they have a bunch of dynamite that's really old and wet, and the nitroglycerin is seeping out, and they try to, like, they go out of their way to try to use this old, you know, stuff instead of just going out and buying some new explosives or something. I mean, it's an oil company. They obviously have money. But apparently there is a scene that got cut from the film where the same reason that the oil rig blows up is that the terrorists have actually stolen, like, all the fresh explosives and used it on the derrick. That's why they don't have any fresher explosives. So
yeah, it was like, it looked like from like a civil war from like decades and decades ago.
Yeah, so these four guys have to very carefully drive this this extremely dangerous seeping nitroglycerin in trucks over, you know, harsh terrain, 218 miles to get it there. And if they can successfully do that, they get paid a ton of money by the oil company, and which would get them, you know, give them enough money to get out of that town and maybe get their life back on track. So, four desperate guys in a desperate situation.
Yeah, who plays the four?
Well, I'm glad you drivers. Asked. I'm glad you asked, Cesar, because I happen to have it written down right here. Well, Francisco Rabal plays a character called Nilo, who we see originally in Vera Cruz at the start of the film. Mm-hmm. He's a paid assassin, and he just kills somebody. It's the opening scene of the movie.
It's a very short, I think, there are vignettes for each of the characters that begin this film.
Well, his is very short and mysterious. His is the shortest, yeah. But the one thing that I really like about his is, it's a really quick moment for him to just shoot the guy and walk out. But what Friedkin does is essentially, like, he has this really long tracking shot of the elevator as the guy comes down the elevator and walks out into the crowded street. And, I like it because it kind of, like you said, it's a little bit mysterious. It makes this guy look cool, you know?
He is cool. He's got the
he's cool.
The best dress.
And I'm gonna point out that he's wearing some white shoes. Let me just preface this by saying, after watching the film again on the Blu-ray for this podcast, I was obsessed with trying to find some sort of meaning out of the prologues, something besides just who these guys were. I kind of felt like, that they were somehow connected in some way, thematically or whatever. So, for example, you know, when we move from Vera Cruz to Jerusalem, the name of the man is the actor's name is Amadou, just one, like Madonna, one name.
Yeah.
And he plays Kasem, who goes by the name of Martinez once they get into Mexico, and he is a Palestinian who helps bomb a Jerusalem bank. In the second prologue, he's carrying a pair of white shoes when you first see him in that shot in Jerusalem, which I thought was just like, well, I thought it was crazy. I was like, white shoes. There's got to be some meaning there, but no, I couldn't find it.
Not with the other two.
I really couldn't find it. Neither Roy Scheider nor Bruno Creme are wearing white shoes, carrying white shoes. There's no shot of white shoes. Maybe Bruno Creme's wife is wearing white shoes in a scene.
You just thought about that now?
Yeah, yeah. I should have checked that.
Well, you know, maybe...
we should pause this so I can put the DVD in.
maybe those other scenes weren't shot by Friedkin, but second unit? You never know.
I doubt it, because it's funny, because the insert shot of the 218 miles on the truck later in the movie, like, Friedkin, like, went ballistic when the studio demanded that he put some insert shots in so that they could... you know, see progress between, you know, as the journey went.
Wow, like, and Indiana Jones,
yeah, and
overlay
and
map.
Yeah, and he got super, he's super egotistical. I mean, William Friedkin's nickname was Hurricane Billy. Like, he really, he got pissed off, and he told the executive that he doesn't shoot goddamn inserts, and, like, if you want inserts, you gotta have somebody else shoot them. And so I doubt there was a lot of second unit in the movie. But anyway,
didn't trust anyone else.
No, I don't want to get too much into his personal life, but, like, you know, a lot of people did not like him. He was,
Well, you mentioned egotism earlier, but like he was coming off some pretty damn huge films, though. So
yeah, well, and that was part of the reason, I think. Mm. Yeah, he just because he had a rough start. He got to start working in a mailroom at a TV studio. It worked his way up, and you know, after The French Connection had been so successful, he followed that up with The Exorcist, and then he didn't do a movie for 4 years before doing Sorcerer. We can come back to that, I think, actually, because I want to get through the prologue characters real quick, just okay. to answer your question, and then we'll, and then we'll move forward. But you know, the Jerusalem segment with Amadou is about Palestinians bombing a bank. And then we move to Paris with Bruno Cremier, and he is—he's actually. They do a good job of setting this up, I think, which becomes very important later for the plausibility of him surviving in the Mexican jungle. He's a blue collar guy. His father was a fisherman. He marries into money and kind of takes into the family business, which is a finance firm.
Yeah, banking institution or something.
Yeah, and so he and his brother-in-law run the firm. They run into some trouble. They apparently have been fudging the books a little bit, and they're unable to get out of it. They're facing jail time. The brother-in-law kills himself, and Bruno, escapes. So from there, you move to Elizabeth, New Jersey, and that's when Roy Scheider's character pops up, Jackie Scanlon. Who in the Mexican scenes goes by the name of Juan Dominguez, which is hilarious. I remember thinking that was hilarious.
Well, there's a scene later on that, like, it shows the absurdity of that.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And he's a low-level guy working for the Irish mob out of New York.
He's a driver.
Well, he's not driving the car, though.
Isn't he?
Is he?
Isn't he?
All right, well,
I'm pretty sure that's his thing. He's the driver.
I think it's ambiguous because he's in on the robbery too. He's not waiting in the car. They're all equal partners in the robbery. But it's Irish mob. The Donnelly gang is the name of the group that he works for. And they knock off a bank or not a bank. I'm sorry. They knock
That's
off,
way off
they knock off a church in Elizabeth, New Jersey that is, protected by Italian mobsters. And so when that goes wrong, everyone dies but him, and he has to escape because he's a marked man and the Italians are going to kill him. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty good, you know, concise setup. Let you know who these guys are, what their background is, so that when you arrive in Mexico, they can...
You know they're stuck there for now.
Yeah, well, you know that this place is hell for them.
Yeah.
You know, literally.
And you know that they're criminals, like, you know.
Right. Yes.
Yes.
We know they're criminals.
You know that they're criminals. Well, I mean, maybe they kind of fit in, because, like, that, you know, everyone in that town is, like, filthy and sleazy. And
it's yeah. But I think that's one of the reasons why they're targeting the American oil company, though, is that they feel like the oil company is there kind of, like, you know, raping their land and taking their riches away. Yeah. There's the rain.
Yeah.
You're going to hear that tap, tap.
Pitter patter.
We're in the jungle in a little hut with an aluminum roof. We're going method for this podcast.
I guess so. Yeah, it does rain in this movie quite a bit.
Yes, it does. Mostly real and some man-made. Yeah. So... I guess the through line here, you know, we've already talked about the basic, you know, plot of the movie. What were some of the things that stuck out for you? Some of the most memorable scenes and things?
I think definitely probably the scene that's become the most iconic. Like, if most people were to choose, like, one frame, it would probably be one of the bits of when the trucks are crossing, like, an Indiana Jones-style rope and, like, plank bridge.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's certainly tense, and... You know, to describe the scene, it's hard to like really kind of like articulate how tense it is. But I was like slowly creeping to the edge of my seat.
Yeah,
that scene ran on.
I remember the night that you watched it, you had posted something online and talked about how butt clenching a movie it was. So I thought
you got to make up words to describe the scene.
No, it's great. It's funny. The rope bridge was metal and hydraulic, and it cost them $1 million to make it. And they
I read somewhere that it was originally built on a different like piece of land or a different body of wire.
Yeah, they spent a long time like gearing up, figuring out how they were going to do it, and they put it over top of this river, and the river like. The dry season hit and the river started to get lower and lower and lower. Mm-hmm. And over the course of just like, I guess it was like a week or so, it got to the point where they could no longer shoot it and make it look good. So they had to figure out. So they went like 100 miles south to a different river and they had to delay the production for an entire month, which created a lot of tension in the production because they had to keep their actors longer than they were supposed to. Mm-hmm. So they paid all the money to break the bridge down, move the bridge, they set it back up, and then that river started to decline. Mm-hmm. And so what they had to do was they had to pay a bunch of extra money to divert other pieces of the river to where they were shooting. Mm-hmm. So it was almost a disaster. Roy Scheider, I don't have the quote in front of me, but in 1977, I guess, when he was interviewed about the film... somebody was asking him about the, because Jaws was a notoriously difficult shoot. Mm-hmm.
Is it something about the films you choose that follows you, like this difficulty?
No, but he said something to the effect of that the Jaws shoot was a cakewalk next to Sorcerer, and that everything you see on that screen, with very, very few exceptions, they actually experience themselves, like when it, storms and rain and delays and the mud and everything, they were very present, during the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I love Roy Scheider, by the way. Can I just say that?
I've heard you say that plenty of times.
For anyone listening who is not as familiar with Roy Scheider as they should be.
If you're listening to a Sorcerer podcast, you definitely should be.
I mean, Jaws and Sorcerer are certainly two, excellent ones. We mentioned The French Connection, which he's also in.
I'd read that initially Friedkin was unsure if Scheider would do the film because he had passed him up.
He wanted Steve McQueen. Okay. Oh, there's a whole huge backstory. Okay. Yeah.
You're right, though.
You should say what you were going to say, though, okay. Because that's an interesting story, though.
That, he was up for French Connection, but he did not get the role.
Yeah, which... No, he's in French Connection. No, he was up for The Exorcist.
Oh, Exorcist.
As Father Karras.
Okay.
Right. And he Friedkin passed on him, and it drove a wedge between them, and they had to talk for a long time. Yeah. But Steve McQueen was originally supposed to play that part, and in the original package that Friedkin set up with the studio, if they had gotten Steve McQueen, Marcello Mastroianni was going to play the Frenchman, and they had a couple other guys who were like bigger name stars. And when McQueen dropped out because Friedkin refused to write a part for Ali McGraw because they had just gotten married,
yeah.
So when Friedkin refused that. McQueen dropped out of the picture and they had to go with Scheider, who was one of the few people the studio would still back it with. And they lost Marcello Mastroianni and the other two guys and had to...
Do you have any idea who the other two actors were?
I don't recall. I know it's in his book and I did read through it, but I can't remember. There are 100 different things that made this like a tough movie to make. And that's certainly not... I mean, from being such a huge movie fan... Like, every movie has that story, where...
Mm-hmm. Like, the what-ifs.
Yeah. Like, Nick Nolte as Han Solo, or William Cott as Luke Skywalker. Things could have happened, or Kubrick's Napoleon or things like that. But George Miller's Justice League, that's what I want to see.
A Chow Yun-Fat as Morpheus.
Yeah. Sean Connery is Morpheus. Will Smith is Neo.
Yeah. Toshiro Mifune as Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, God, that would have been awesome. I almost want to travel back in time and fund Star Wars so that he could do Toshiro Mifune.
Listen, but George.
Alec Guinness is great, though.
Listen, George.
Alec Guinness. It's Alec Guinness.
Alec what Guinness?
I was going to say Alec fucking Guinness, yeah. But, it didn't roll off the tongue quite as well as I expected it to.
He's not Irish.
He's not Irish. He's British. He's English.
English and British.
Well, back then it wasn't Britain, though, right?
They were still separate.
Yeah.
I don't really know much.
When did that happen?
I think they're separate right now.
We'll cut that out. Nah, we'll leave it in. Who cares? When it comes to history...
from what I hear, you're from over there. They're not very united right now either, so...
No, no. Brexit.
Okay, let's continue.
Okay, so the bridge scene, which is what you were talking about,
okay.
It's terrific.
It's a very long sequence. In the film, there are two separate trucks where... One, I guess they kind of see it as a backup because they fully, you know, the company who's financing this journey of transport of the nitroglycerin, they certainly, they reference it, the characters do, that they don't believe that all of them are going to make it.
Right. It's so dangerous that there's a good chance that one or both are going to bite the dust.
Yeah. So, you know, you see one scene in particular that's quite long, which has Amido and Bruno Creme in one truck. Transporting the truck across this really unsteady looking bridge, and it's I guess that scene is probably
early one at the beginning, the first one, he finds the note.
Yeah,
okay.
It's
that's still pretty tense.
Yeah, how long do you think that scene is? It's probably like
2 minutes.
No. That's not in the rain is what I'm talking about. Not like that earlier one where it's like.
I think if you
it's
add,
like not the plank bridge.
If you add both scenes together, it's like 10 to 12 minutes.
No, it feels a hell of a lot longer, though.
Yeah. Well, that's what tension does. It tends to it tends to slow down time. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I mean, it also works because like the truck is creeping. It's not like kind of like a rush kind of thing which you would see like an action film where. You know, like it would fall, like planks or bridges would fall down behind it as a car would be driving across. You know,
Friedkin does a great thing with the sound though, because he makes it a point to like crank up the sound of the engine, like to give it more tension. Mm-hmm. So every time they have to touch the gas, it's like it's loud. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're expecting something bad to happen each time.
Yeah, there are scenes in that sequence where. They can't hear each other because of the howling wind and the blaring engine and stuff. So I think,
yeah, in that scene in particular, the bridge where the Amadou and Bruno Creme are, that is man-made rain.
Yeah, I think I'd read that. The Blu-ray inexplicably does not have a lot of supplemental features, though, unfortunately. But
no,
I imagine a lot of it's lost though.
It does. Yeah, it's in my hand right now.
I see it.
It does have excerpts from the Friedkin Connection, though. So,
I did read it. Yeah. It's not like fresh in my head because I guess I saw Source like a month ago, maybe, in preparation for this.
We're professionals.
Yeah. We're way ahead.
No, so any other scenes besides the bridge scene? The bridge scene, you're right, is absolutely, positively the most iconic thing about it. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene... just before they set out, where the four men we're following are not the original four men, necessarily, or one of them earns a spot through despicable means.
Sure. The older white-haired guy, I do not have his name, sorry about that. But yes, he is killed by Nilo.
Now... In the beginning of the film, they established that the one actor from Veracruz, the assassin, he definitely shows up and he's dressed differently, and he immediately locals take notice of him. This is certainly intentional, but like the whole time, because I hadn't seen Wages or anything like that, you know, you definitely feel that he's perhaps after Roy Scheider's character. And that's why he, you know, worms his way into a spot on his truck.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you do think he has ulterior motives for being there because...
He seems definitely a little bit crazy. You know, he's laughing in the rain and...
Well, that's later, though, yeah.
Well, yeah.
He's not used to... Mm-hmm. Like, he's a professional killer, but he seems more like a gentleman killer. He doesn't seem like he would be at home on a camping trip, you know, the way that the other guy, the other three guys do. But
on a camping trip.
Well, you know what I mean.
This is a camping trip.
That's essentially what it is. That, you know, like they're out in the wilderness together. So, you know, his shoes are wrong, his pants are wrong, like everything he's wearing is a little bit too highfalutin for
Why are you wearing long sleeves? It's so hot.
I mean, he's got I mean, it's Scheider's hat, his fedora is great, you know. It, like Scheider's character like costuming is modeled after Bogart in Treasure of Sierra Madre, which is another amazing, you know, tense film by a great American director, John Huston. Like, it's so clear, like, if you look at, you know, a picture of Bogart in that movie and then look at a picture of Scheider in Sorcerer, it's, like, it's so clear. It was, and Friedkin has cited Sierra Madre.
Is he wearing the same hat that he had in the, like, the beginning of the film? Like,
No.
I was thinking, you know, maybe it's like, never mind. I was thinking about the way you're looking for a connection with like the shoes. It doesn't seem like that makes sense. It...
No, well, you know, speaking of the connections, like, you know, so there's the white shoes with Nilo's character that Amadou's character, he's carrying a pair of white shoes at the beginning of the Jerusalem segment. And then, you know, Jerusalem, obviously, you know, big religious town, that Jerusalem.
That's what I hear. A lot of faith in there.
But then Scheider's character knocks over a church. So you've got, and, you know, Vera Cruz and Paris both have, like, giant Christian cathedrals. So, like, I kind of felt like there was a whole thing about, like...
Do you see a cathedral in the Vera Cruz segment? I mean, it's very short.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But... You know,
you don't really have any indication of like any kind of religious, in the Paris sequence either.
In the Paris sequence, when Bruno Creme and his wife are eating with a friend, one of her friends, she's talking about salmon, right?
I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure it's salmon.
I remember thinking that like he was very disinterested in it because he had like all the worry about like his current legal situation.
Yeah. But they're talking about, it's some fish, I'm pretty sure it's salmon. And
is that the dumb stuff that rich people talk about?
No, but the woman that they're having lunch with talks about having just been to Vera Cruz and she didn't like the salmon. And then the wife says that you have to go to a colder climate. And then that's when it comes up that his father was a fisherman.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So like, you know, their guest was just in Vera Cruz, which is where we were. You know, when we see...
Two segments ago.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, there's all these little, like, weird connections in those prologues that, like I said, it drove me crazy. Like, I was telling our friend Joe, one day we were driving home from seeing a movie, and I was, like, I was naming all these things off, and I was, like, there's got to be something. And ultimately, 20 minutes later, I was, like... No, I guess there isn't.
Get out of the car.
It's just William Friedkin playing with my mind.
He's Kaiser Soze'd us.
Well, there's a lot of Christian symbolism and a lot of Christian references. Like the name of the trucks, the peligro is in Spanish, that means danger or peril. And the other truck is Lazaro, which, you know, Lazarus, you know, which literally translated means whom God helps. Which is the one that Roy Scheider is driving. And one who makes it to the end.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't gotten to talking about the end of the movie yet, which I love, but what about this Tangerine Dream score?
It's pretty memorable.
Yeah.
And you're talking 1970 Tangerine Dream, not without like, you know, the frequent shakeup of members which they've had in the years since. It's I don't know how to describe this. Well, you know, I'm certainly...
It's used pretty sparsely, I would say.
Like, I think it's memorable, though, because, I think sometimes the absence of a score, especially in a film like this, tends to add, like, you know, that level of tenseness. One of the things I've noticed in a lot of action films, and, you know, hopefully people here know, maybe they know, that I'm a big fan of, like, martial arts cinema or action scenes, hand-to-hand stuff.
You don't say.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm wearing a Gordon Liu shirt right now.
You are.
Yeah. Hope you guys can hear it.
Eight diagram but
there,
bullfighter.
There are certainly like scenes where an action scene without like accompanying music, it really makes it feel a lot harder. So I think.
Sorry, I'm nodding. It's radio. Yeah. I'm nodding.
Yeah. So the fact that this, the fact that like they don't use that score that often, when it does come up, you know it's important, and like it's I think the most striking one is towards the end when Roy Scheider is by himself.
Sure.
But like, you know,
the hallucination.
We'll save that for a little bit later, yeah, because you know that is the end of the film. We haven't quite.
Well, it kicks that point in yet. in the Jerusalem prologue when you see, I guess it's the Israeli army, mm-hmm, or Israeli police forces
coming to get them.
I don't know how they knew who it was or how they got there so fast, but it really doesn't matter. But there's a nice locked down shot on the back of like a Jeep with a gunner, and as it goes through the streets, that's when you get your first dose of that Tangerine Dream score, which is pretty awesome. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
So I like Tangerine Dream scores for the other movies that I've seen. You know, like Legend is another big one. Mm-hmm. Ridley Scott, the American version of Legend, not the Jerry Goldsmith international version, but
yeah. International version.
Yeah, that's if you get the Legend 2 disc set, it's got both versions of the movie. It's got an international cut with different.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have that. I don't think I've watched the.
Yeah.
I've watched one version.
Yeah, it's got an orchestral score by Jerry Goldsmith and some alternate scenes and takes, and it's longer. Mm. And then the American version is, you know, shorter and has the Tangerine Dream score.
I think
this seems really otherworldly. I really like it a lot.
Like this is a tangent, but I really miss. I mean, it's coming back a little bit, having like musical groups actually provide scores instead of
Fincher's been doing a good job with Trent Reznor.
Yeah.
You know, on some of those
Oscar movies. Winner.
Yeah. Social Network and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was them too, right? And his most recent movie, right?
I don't know. I don't know about Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. They use his music in the trailer, but I've never seen.
I'm gonna check.
I've never seen his version, but yeah, you know, like Goblin and Vangelis doing a lot of films in like the 70s and 80s. So.
Vangelis score for Blade Runner. Mm. Oh. Man,
I think we should watch one of those. We should watch different versions, and then we'll talk about it. Coming soon, guys.
Okay.
Coming soon, guys.
All right. Well, I think
we mentioned earlier that like the end of the film, the hallucination scene.
Yeah.
Where Scheider's like by himself, and I guess that's definitely a spoiler, guys.
We're doing spoilers anyway.
Yeah.
It's fine.
If you haven't paid attention the last 30 minutes,
you shouldn't be listening to a podcast about the movie.
But, you know, if you stuck around, thank you. But, like, I guess I'm not sure where they shot it, but it definitely doesn't, that area definitely doesn't feel like part of that.
It's not.
Like, that terrain. It's probably shot in,
it's like the Yucca Salt Flats or something. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Very, very otherworldly and almost like, what's that? That rock formation that like the film Up, the locale was based off of. You know, just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird like rock formations and like eroded structures and stuff.
Well, I was gonna say I'm gonna rewind for a second and go back to you know like the idea that that you know these four men, obviously. You know, they're all in this place under, you know, terrible circumstances. You know, it's hell for them. Literally hell. Like that geyser of, you know, that inferno of red fire shooting out of the ground is obviously symbolic of that. Which provides some nice symmetry in the Elizabeth sequence when Scheider flips the car. And everyone dies except him.
Yeah, it's the fire hydrant.
Yeah, they knock out a fire hydrant, and it shoots up water into the air. And I always liked that that sort of like visual symmetry between those two images.
The car flips, right? Yeah. The hydrant's the thing that flips it.
Yeah, well, it's shooting that apparently was very difficult, and they brought a couple.
No kidding. There's a scene in this movie that had difficult shooting. Uh-huh.
Well, they brought a couple of different teams in, and they couldn't get it right, and apparently...
Like, they couldn't flip the car?
Yeah, they couldn't get it to look the way Friedkin wanted it, and so finally he brought in, I can't remember the guy's name, but a specialist, and they
I said that guy's assassin, in his other lifetime, other life.
They worked on it for a couple of weeks, and when they finally got time to do it, they did it one take. Hmm. So, but you know, obviously these guys are at odds against one another because they're all sort of vying for, you know, their piece of what is a very small pie in that, you know, that.
Yeah, there's an agreement that if they share before they go out, that anyone who dies, like, their cut would also be shared amongst whoever survives. So, I mean, there's not necessarily competition. Though I guess I kind of got a hint of that, like, at the very start, when everyone had a little bit more confidence going out.
Yeah.
Before they kind of hit, like, the entire shitstorm of that's the journey. But, like, I think one of the things about the movie is that the truck affords them that they have to have a certain level of trust between them. And, you know, we established earlier that they're criminals, so definitely they're there hiding out, and, like, the trust doesn't come easily. But, like, it's like a bonding film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was just going to say that because they get to a certain point where they obviously have to work together. And it's, I guess, the power of money and the idea that this hope that they have to eventually escape, you know, this prison that they're in. You know, I mean, it's funny, you know, all of them kind of fled their homeland to avoid prison. But they're kind of locked in their own, like, jungle prison together. Mm-hmm. You know, and the movie kind of works on that level with these guys in a very close, I don't know, it's just a good guys movie. it like, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's certainly, they're, like, the bonding elements, like, you would not expect, because, I mean, you had, like, a Palestinian terrorist and, like, a white-collar criminal.
Right.
Like, you know. Talking about their past lives. Well, one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Amidao, he tends to be pretty tight-lipped. Mm. Yeah. But he does have his moment to shine where at that point he's
obviously the one that has the most experience with explosives.
Yeah.
So when they have that scene with the fallen tree, you know, he's the one who comes up with the idea to use the nitroglycerin to destroy the tree that's in front of the road. Which, that's a pretty good scene, too. Really impressive, you know, because they obviously really blew up that giant tree. You know, this is before the age of CGI. And that, you know, I think there were three cameras going in that scene for that explosion. But that explosion's, like, really impressive, like, with all the wood chips flying everywhere and everything. So, that for me, that's another one of the great images when that thing explodes. But these guys start to work together as a team. You know, the montage of them fixing up the trucks is really good. I like that a lot. You know, it almost reminds me a little bit, even though this movie was made well before it, but, you know, like the great 80s action montages when the people would gear up, like Rambo or Commando.
Yeah, Commando is the first thing I see in my mind.
So, well, Rambo's got, like, an exact duplicate of that, right? Mm. Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Well, what year that? I guess Commando's like 86, 87. Maybe
First Blood Part 2 was probably before that because First Blood is a 70s movie.
It's also not as ridiculous as Commando, too.
No, Commando's so great, though. Yeah. I love that, you know, the idea that these guys are sort of in close quarters. They get irritated, but they sort of depend on each other as well, you know, for survival and everything. So in that way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, Fury with Brad Pitt.
Oh.
Like, how
Trial by Fire kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, Fury, they're more of a family.
Yeah, I definitely think that. But, so like when Logan Lerman's character, he's the outsider, definitely. Yeah,
but
he's still, our perspective, so. Yeah,
I still get that feeling, though, watching Sorcerer, that these guys, like, you know, they're essentially, they're going through a war zone together. They're battling together, And that's, to me, that's, like, you know, a lot of the great war movies have that same kind of element to it. Mm-hmm. So, how did you like the ending? Because I'm a big fan of the ending. For me personally.
Okay. Well, the ending in where Roy Scheider succeeds and saves the town, I guess. That's how people feel about it. The ending is kind of ambiguous.
I don't think it's ambiguous at all.
About the fate of the character?
Okay.
I don't know. I think it probably is. Okay, well, the ending. You want to say what the ending is? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, well, obviously after everyone else is killed, Roy Scheider drives the truck as far as he possibly can, and he gets, I guess it's 216 miles, so he still has 2 miles left to carry a box of dynamite ready to go off at any moment.
And do you think he was, like,
yeah, he's so exhausted that when you see him walking with it, he almost looks drunk. You know, he's stumbling around because of exhaustion and madness, really, as well. He's going crazy.
Well, I mean, how many times have you, driven home after work and then, like, aren't aware, and then you just wake up in your driveway
somehow? I don't know, that's never happened, but
I mean, not after you fall asleep. It's just that you don't...
I did almost fall asleep driving home from Atlantic City once on 95, and that was that was something I hope never to repeat again. So, but yeah, so he delivers the nitroglycerin because he is the only person who survives. He gets the entire share for himself, so he becomes a rich man. He doesn't seem terribly happy about it because he knows that. He probably can't go anywhere and escape his fate. Mm-hmm. I think the whole movie's about fate for me. Mm-hmm. These guys try to escape it, but it always catches up with them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, going back to the camaraderie that they develop the other truck, the two drivers, or I guess the two transporters, they end up getting killed simultaneously, whereas he and his partner do not get killed. As a result of the explosion.
They get held up by bandits.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
We don't need no stinking badges.
Exactly. So there's a scene where, like the camaraderie where he and... it's the assassin from Veracruz.
Right.
They,
Nilo.
They end up... I guess at the moment of death, he kind of makes a promise to him that he fully intends to keep.
Sure.
So he's not going to be in that town anymore, but he wants to, kind of... live. I can't remember what the name of the town that they're supposed to go to, but whore it up,
right?
I guess as a way to kind of honor like fallen comrade.
Yeah, I think it's funny always in movies that that when guys are close to death, they always want to like to have a threesome with two hookers. Like that's like
the best hookers in town.
Yeah, I guess that's like there's that to look forward to. I guess.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe there's something like that I look forward to.
Well, he doesn't get there. At least, you said you thought it was ambiguous. But essentially, yeah, he becomes a hero for the town. He cleans himself up. He's got a plane waiting for him.
Mr. Dominguez.
Yeah. And so he essentially asks the plane to wait for a few minutes. He dances with a local woman who is set up earlier in the movie as someone who works at the little the dive bar / cafe that they all hang out at. And
it was a waitress who seemed like she had affection for
the Frenchman.
Yes,
right?
For Frenchman. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of reeling a little bit.
Yeah, well, when they leave, she delivers something for him, and we never find out what that is. So he just gives sort of like a knowing glance.
Yeah,
like after she gives it to him. So as he's dancing, freaking cuts to outside. A car comes up, and two men, armed men, get out of the car and walk in, and the camera just pulls back.
Well, the one armed man was
it's the guy who initially helps
him escape.
Helps him escape. But their conversation when that happens is, "I owed you a favor, and now you're on your own. Like we're even."
Yeah.
So it was clear from that conversation earlier in the film that he's tied to the mob. Mm-hmm. So I took that, and the other guy is. The guy who was talking
in the restaurant,
in the restaurant talking to the Italian mob boss.
Yeah. It's not the guy that answered the phone though, right? He's the other guy. There's three of them.
It's the guy sitting there with him, mm-hmm. who is explaining to him what happened to his brother, who was the priest that got shot. So I think the combination of those two guys showing up there, he's dead.
Okay.
Yeah, well, they're just going to walk in and like they might not kill him right then and there. They might take him back to America and let somebody else do it, but he's dead. There's no getting out of it.
So. See, I think the ambiguity that I drew from that is because you don't see it happen. So it's certainly
It's implied though. Yeah. I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it's implied. Yeah,
but you also have, I mean, this is a town, I'm sure they're not the only ones who are hiding out from something. There are in the bar at the time, there are police officers who are definitely dirty, so you could assume that either maybe they're aware of what's coming, because it's not like this is a way it's not a town where people can just arrive and no one notices.
I think it's possible that those corrupt cops who were trying to blackmail him for being Juan Dominguez, the Roy Scheider character, for being Juan Dominguez earlier, it's quite possible that they're the ones who reached out thinking that he was a wanted man, and you know.
That's possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. I mean, you know, they definitely have no qualms about.
I mean, that might be my own personal fan fiction, but
they know he's got money now, more money than almost anyone else in the town. So
yeah,
and you know, earlier on, you see when they hassle him, but you have no qualms about taking out of his wallet, literally at the beginning.
Yep. So I would wholeheartedly recommend that you see Sorcerer.
Yeah, I think you got to be prepared though. Like it's definitely. You know, I can't even honestly say it's a slow burn because, I was never bored. And I was not that a slow burn.
I think it's intriguing, though. The lengths he goes to set things up and put the building blocks there before you get to the point when the oil rig explodes and the actual plot of the movie comes together. Mm-hmm. I always felt like it was building to something. And does build to an explosion at that point.
Political unrest. And, I mean, you see propaganda posters on the wall.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, so I guess you assume whatever country that they're in. I don't think it's ever made explicit. But, it's...
You know, like I was telling you earlier, I think
you're in a warlord situation. Kind of.
I think it's the eastern, southern Gulf region of Mexico, but it could be somewhere else.
Yeah, I didn't get that impression because I think you said you were looking up flags and stuff. Yeah. I don't recall seeing a Mexican flag.
No, you don't. But when I tried to look up the flags that are in the movie, I don't know if it's because those countries don't exist the way they used to 40 years ago, but I could not find an exact match. So it might be on purpose. It might be because they didn't want to actually call out a specific nation,
Maybe if someone watches it, maybe they can identify the kind of Spanish that's spoken in the film. Yeah. Not that that's necessarily the end-all answer to that question.
Yes, if you know, please.
If you know Spanish dialects,
put it in the comments section.
I'd like to know.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the kind of movie that would certainly appeal to people who gritty, edgy guys movies. I would put this into a category with something like
Easy Rider,
Papillon, Apocalypse Now, like those kinds of 70s era movies where you've got people who maybe don't even like each other on a journey together with common goals, stuck in places that they didn't necessarily ask to be in some cases, in the case of Papillon, they're in a prison escaping. So let's
bring it back to that. The prison reference.
Yeah. Well, Friedkin was the most successful American studio director of the 70s besides Coppola. I mean Scorsese had his hits. Spielberg kind of owns the big budget movies of the late 70s, but when it comes to from 1970 to 1975 or 6, Coppola and Friedkin have the biggest monster giant hits, with the two Godfather movies and, with French Connection and The Exorcist. The French Connection won Best Picture. The Exorcist was the highest grossing movie the year it came out. The Godfather movies both won Best Picture and were high grossing movies, if not the highest of their year. I don't know for sure. but uh, I I've read, not from Friedkin's mouth, but from other people who knew him, that Coppola was certainly the guy he was always chasing, and that when Coppola decided to take on Apocalypse Now, it was only then that Friedkin was like, oh, I'm going to fucking do Wages of Fear then. You know, like, so it was kind of like they were trying to one-up each other.
I wonder what, if Coppola felt the same way.
I, no idea. But I think, to be honest, like, Coppola doesn't strike me as that kind of guy. Coppola's
easy Italian guy drinking wine in his vineyard.
Well, but he was much more interested in like making sure at the time that his business it wasn't about his personal success. It was about making sure American Zoetrope was doing okay, which is why he was fostering young talent like George Lucas and making movies like American Graffiti under his banner. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think that competitiveness probably also was working the same way from Coppola that it was from Friedkin, but it seems to obviously be there with Friedkin.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, Friedkin, this movie bombed. This movie like, lost money.
One of the biggest bombs.
Yeah, I mean,
at the time.
Until its theatrical re-release, just, I guess, what was it, 2 years ago?
More than that, probably.
2 or 3 years ago. It had only made $12 million in the United States. You know, so it obviously lost money. I mean, they spent over $3 million just on the bridge. So had to cost
them. It shows, though, guys.
Yeah. So, but Friedkin, like,
but the, well, really the movie was in hard litigation for a long time, too, I think, right? For,
well, if it had been a bigger success.
Was it Paramount? Yeah.
Well,
it was Paramount at the time.
Well, it was co-produced by Universal and Paramount, which is why some of the murky legalities surrounding the release of it more recently came out. So it was co-produced at the beginning and it didn't do well. And for years, Paramount is the one who had the prints, apparently. Mm-hmm. So Paramount and Universal would just kind of sign off and let anybody run it if they wanted to run it. And then a couple of years ago, or I guess probably about 5 years ago at this point, someone contacted Friedkin and said that they were denied a print from Paramount. And it was, I don't remember who it was, but it was somebody big. It wasn't like the AFI, but it was like, you know, it was like a college or something. And mm-hmm. they would not permit them to show the movie. So Friedkin got involved and he went to the studio and the studio said, we don't own the rights to this movie. And he was like, well, who owns the fucking rights then? And they were like, we don't know. So then he went to Universal, and he was like, you know, do you have the rights? And they were like, we don't know who has the rights either. Like, and we don't have the time to, like, get into this. Like, we're too busy. And so,
I'm sure about the tour.
Yeah. Well, so what he had to do is he had to sue the studios in court to find out who owned it. And if they didn't own it, then he owned it.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially they were able to iron all that out and he was able to get them to do a new restoration and show the movie and all the benefits from the restoration and the stuff that it made theatrically went to charity. He didn't make anything off of it. He just wanted the movie to be available. So, I mean,
I'm sure like, you know, a film like that where he's really suffered for, like, it's very personal. Like, I'm not sure how he ranks in his filmography, but it's got to be up there.
Well, these days he says he thinks it's his finest movie, but back then I'm not sure he would have said that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an older man looking back fondly on something that he went through a lot to make. Like you said, it's personal. Yeah, I'm glad he did. Yeah, because for years, you know, working at Suncoast, we carried a really crap pan and scan version in our horror section. Which had a really cool like cover of Roy Scheider with like a red sorcerer across his face, but like I refused to get a pan and scan copy because I knew, you know, that I didn't want to watch it that way, and I had heard that the print was actually bad too.
Yeah.
So I've never seen that version.
I don't doubt it. Yeah.
So I just held off and hoped for years that this movie would get the treatment that it deserved, and finally it did. So when it was released theatrically, I went to see it. Like fell in love with it. I really couldn't believe how it languished for so long. Such an amazing.
When you saw it theatrically, was that the Charles?
Yes.
Was there a decent crowd that was there? Or?
Yeah. So it was in their main auditorium, and I mean, you know, it was a couple of years ago, but I mean, you know, they probably can can hold 400 in that theater, and it was at least half full. So, but I'm glad I bought the Blu-ray right away when it came out. I've watched it a couple times, you know, rewatched it recently for us to talk about it, and yeah, I really, really like this movie a lot. It's you know, the quote on the front says it's the toughest, most relentless American film in a long time, which is a quote from Newsweek back in 1977.
One of the few people who really periodicals that probably reviewed it well, huh?
Yeah, well, the LA Times ripped it, and with it, Friedkin's heart apparently, because he was apparently very close to the guy who wrote the.
They were.
Yeah. So. But anyway, so you know, obviously, I think this is a two thumbs up.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you haven't, I guess if you haven't gathered from the way we speak about this film, I would go so far to say it's a must watch. I mean, if you're looking for like great American cinema and something that you're unlikely to see today, yeah. You're never going to see a movie like this today.
I mean, it's obviously made by an American filmmaker, but because of the international cast and the locations and everything, like
it's pretty.
Yeah,
it seems pretty accessible.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's just such a masculine film. You know, it's the shooting style, the editing, the music. You know, everything is just.
It's brawny.
Yeah. So watch Sorcerer, please.
Yeah, watch Sorcerer, guys.
Watch it. Watch it. Tell us what you think. Leave a comment below.
Yeah.
And
I guess we're going to be recording again sometime soon. I don't think we're certain
next week
what we're going to be discussing.
We got to do Dog Day.
Dog Day?
Yeah, okay. We're going to do Dog Day Afternoon.
Okay. But if you guys want to hear us discuss something, make sure it's a good film, hopefully.
If it's not a good film, I won't watch it. So. That's actually not true.
I've seen many bad films.
Well, last night, we'd hung out for a different work function. And what was the movie, the Stacey Keach movie you were showing clips of?
The Dion Brothers.
I want to see that. I think that looks...
it looks awesome.
When he is, like, making his muscles and screaming that he's, like, fucking Kirk Douglas, I fell in love with that.
Did you... Like, I totally forgot that Margot Kidder was in that film.
Yeah, she looks good, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you can hardly tell it's her because she doesn't look all coked up yet.
Well, it's like... I guess that film was probably made a year or two before...
Before Superman. Yeah. Cool, before she ruined herself. Yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to find a copy of that movie, then.
Yes, please do. We'll review it on the show.
It'll probably be full frame.
We'll do a double feature with the Dion Brothers and Miami Connection.
Literally that scene when he's in the thing and he's saying that he could be fucking Kirk Douglas. I was like, this is one of the greatest things ever.
Yeah, and the mustache. The Keach mustache.
Talk about brawny films.
I'm going to have to grow one of those.
Well, November's coming up.
There you go. I'll have to get it before Halloween.
Do you tap dance too?
Yeah. All right.
Coming soon, guys. All right.
So we're going to be watching Dog Day Afternoon for next time. So if you guys have the opportunity to watch it, so we can discuss it in the comment sections. And where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I write for Asian film cinema sites, www.filmsmash.com.
Film Smash!
Yeah, and then you could follow me on Twitter at Junior Biho.
And you're also going to be three Otakon panels this year?
I have two panels this year.
Two panels at Otakon this year.
If you're going to be in Baltimore this August 12th to 14th.
Yep, and what are the two panels?
I'm doing... juvenile delinquency in Japanese cinema.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. And we mentioned Brexit earlier, though I'm not sure if that bit's going to make the cut on here. But
not cutting anything.
But I also have a panel for the best Hong Kong cinema after 1997 when Britain left Hong Kong.
Awesome.
So more recent stuff, which, you know, there's terrific cinema out there, but, you know, everyone seems to look fondly on older stuff, especially like... This kind of subgenre niche viewership that it gets.
Cool. Looking forward to that. All right. And as always, I'm CJ Talbot. You can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame or settingtheframe.blogspot.com. And we'll look forward to talking with you guys soon, and I'll see you next week.
I don't know. Star Trek is this week, yeah, so we'll probably catch in the theater.
Yeah, but I'll still see you next week. That's my closing line. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for stopping by.
Go fuck yourself, San Diego.